This is Radio Influence. Podcasting redefined.
He got him in the white trunks. He heard him.
That's beautiful. Oh, God. That's beautiful. He's got it.
And he forced the top. Wow. And here's the submission. And it's all over. It's nice. All over. First round knockout.
Big is how Rich Franklin retains his belt.
The one thing that I never thought in a million years would happen, happened.
The champion. The challenger. Here we go.
This is the MMA Report with Jason Floyd on Radio Influence.
UFC Fight Night 121, Verdum versus Tybura, is going to take place on Sunday morning in Sydney, Australia, Saturday night here in the United States, and we're going to preview this fight card here on this episode of the MMA Report Preview Podcast on Radio Influence. Daniel Galvan and I, of course, are going to talk about the incident that happened earlier this week between Fabricio Verdum and Colby Covington. Plus, we'll give you our top three fights. We'll give you some betting underdogs that we think have a chance to cash in for you. We'll give our bonus picks. Plus, at the end of the podcast, we'll talk about some other MMA news and notes going on, including the casting call for the Ultimate Fighter Season 27, UFC 219 now having a title fight. Plus, we'll talk a little bit about that tape delay show that took place on Thursday. That's airing tonight, Friday night here in the United States, Bellator 188. We will not give away who won the fights, but we'll kind of mention the fights that you can watch on Friday night on Spike TV. Of course, we are brought to you by Fight TV. The Fight app is your wrestling, MMA, and boxing TV. Watch live pay-per-views and free programming on your own schedule. You can download the Fight app free today by going to Fight, FITE.TV. /radio influence/. Once again, that is Fight, FITE.TV/radio influence/. And coming up on Saturday afternoon, it will be ACB 74. Adam Townsend's going to be in the main event of this fight card. Also, some notable fighters that you'll recognize are on this fight card. Efren Escudero, he's in the co-main event of this fight card. Clifford Starks, who's fought in UFC and Bellator, he's on this fight card. Thiago Silva is also on this fight card. Akup Sapanian. Of course, you may remember him from his time in Bellator, all part of that fight card, which you can watch live and free on Fight on Saturday starting at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. Daniel, it's, you know, I think, you know, you mentioned earlier this week, and I mentioned earlier this week when we did the regular podcast about chaos. I guess that's another great word to describe what we have seen happened over the past 2 days.
Do you think the UFC brass are a bunch of evil genius manatees in some type of storage room that are making us pay attention to these cards? Because there is something really ingenious about what took place this week. Boomerang Gate. We obviously cared about this card. Me and you personally were aware that this card was happening, but I'm sure the mass public did not. And because of what took place here with Fabricio Verdum throwing a boomerang at Colby Covington, and then Colby Covington proceeding to, you know, the first part of the bigotry bingo card, he hit it like a couple weeks ago where he was racist. Now he's homophobic. He's really doing a number. Yeah, anyways, bottom line, all this crazy stuff happened. Now we're aware there's a fight card with Fabricio Verdum this week. Are the UFC geniuses?
There's no way they could draw this up of, hey, Fabricio, we want you to throw a boomerang at Colby Covington, which, by the way, Colby Covington was there as a guest fighter. He basically do a lot of PR. The UFC did send Colby Covington home after this situation, but kind of before all this, you know, went down, one of my thoughts I had about Colby Covington is he has done a tremendous job of keeping his name in the newsfeed. I relate it to a lot of when Ali Abdelaziz was a matchmaker for World Series of Fighting, where he always kept the World Series of Fighting in the newsfeed. You know, whether you went to MMA Junkie or MMA Fighting, when Ali was the matchmaker for the World Series of Fighting, he always had the World Series of Fighting out there in the newsfeed. So you always kind of knew what was going on with the WSOF. And I kind of feel that that's what Colby Covington has done here over the past couple of months. However, as a fighter, how do you press assault charges? I ultimately wonder, is this more Colby Covington is just trying to screw, just basically mess with Fabricio Verdum from a financial aspect, because now Fabricio is going to have to appear in Australian court next month.
Look, man, at the end of the day, it's important to have empathy for people, and especially if they are a victim and they're pressing charges. With that being said, I mean, Colby Covington, you're an absolute wussy. Like, what is going on? You're pressing charges because a dude threw a boomerang at you? And I'm pretty sure Colby Covington may have instigated the fight or at least fired it on there. At the end of the day, Colby Covington doesn't necessarily have the benefit of the doubt as the UFC's top peacekeeper. Just a wussy move. Like I don't understand how you can come across as this awesome tough guy when you get nicked by a crappy boomerang toy. You know, and a boomerang, yes, is a deadly weapon. Sure. I did some research, Jason. I Googled, has anyone ever died from a boomerang? And apparently 800 years ago, there was a man. His name was Kakucha. He died 800 years ago. Apparently he had a lot of like fractures in his skull because that was a part of his lifestyle, messing around with boomerangs. And his last meal was crayfish and possum, which sounded kind of awful. But that was probably a much more dangerous boomerang with like a sharper edge and stuff. So, yeah. Colby Covington, absolutely bad move. But you mentioned like the dark underpinnings of what's going on here. And what is going on here is people are talking about Colby Covington. And what that means is he's becoming more and more of a name, whatever that means. The next time he fights, more people will know about him. Very much like the Eric Bischoff strategy, the book he wrote. It's not really his strategy because it's not like some amazing thought. But controversy creates cash. If your name is in the news, people care about you over time. They know who you are, and that really matters. Now, what Colby needs to watch out for and what Connor has to watch out for, too, that this is a theme I've been thinking about the last couple of weeks, given what we saw at McGregor, you cannot work yourself into a shoot. That's a pro wrestling term. What that means is you say some of these outlandish statements in order to get heat, get attention. But if you lose sight of the business and if you lose sight of what's right and what's wrong in the line, and you cross that line way too much, like jumping into a cage or using a homophobic slur, you can work yourself into a shoot and people will turn on you in a bad way. In that, we will not watch Colby Covington fights because he's offensive. And at the end of the day in 2017, or really in any freaking year, you should not say a homophobic slur. That type of language should be eradicated kind of from our lexicon. And every time somebody uses it, we should absolutely chastise him for doing so. So Colby Covington needs to be mature enough to understand not to work himself into a shoot, but unfortunately I'm not super sure if Colby has that ability.
But one of the things this incident has caused is actually bring a decent amount of attention on this fight card, which obviously in the MMA community people were, I think, pretty much aware of this fight card. I mean, it's a fight card that, you know, as you look up and down it doesn't have, you know, I think the Tim Means below Muhammad fight should be a great matchup. It's actually my pick for fight of the night, but it has brought attention because it's now gotten, this fight card has gotten coverage from outlets that, you know, may cover MMA every once in a while. And it will be interesting. You know, Marcin Tybura kind of has become a little bit of the forgotten guy. I mean, you think of what he has gone through leading up to this matchup with initially scheduled to take on Mark Hunt. And, of course, you know, Mark Hunt gets pulled from this fight card due to that article that came out. And now Fabricio steps in, who's now having his third fight in less than 5 months, which, you know, you kind of, if you rewind back to about 11 months ago, the UFC wasn't exactly too thrilled with Fabricio Werdum after the whole, you know, when Cain pulled out of their fight of the December pay-per-view last year. And, you know, he fell out of favor with the UFC, and now he's taking these fights. And, you know, I know that, you know, Fabricio's looking at, you know, getting this fight and getting a title matchup. But to me, he's odd man out in terms of the UFC heavyweight title picture. We talked about this earlier this week with Stipe and kind of what could be next. You know, all signs are now kind of leaning towards potentially Stipe headlining the Boston pay-per-view, potentially against Cain Velasquez. You know, I think if you're Alistair over, or excuse me, if you're Fabricio Werdum, you have to be rooting, I don't know who you root for the Overeem fight, because I think whoever wins the Overeem and Ngannou fight would be the backup plan potentially if Kane's not ready for January. But I do feel that Francis Ngannou beats Alistair Overeem, you know, he's really the guy I think the UFC wants to put in that title fight.
Yeah, no, if you're rooting for Overeem to beat Ngannou, obviously, because Francis is the type of fighter that I mean, to me, the way the line looks, it's Kane, Francis, and then honestly, you can make a case for either Overeem or Verdum. Probably Overeem over Verdum, given Overeem's last win is over Fabricio. But Fabricio's kind of been much more on our minds lately, given the most recent domination of Walters, and then the fight that he's about to have now, and kind of a lot of the controversy. So, I think for Verdum, best case scenario for him getting a championship shot within the next 4 to 6 months is simply a late injury replacement. That's what he's got to hope for, because currently you look at the landscape of the heavyweight division, he doesn't appear to have a dancing partner that will get him to the ball, because you have Overeem and Francis that are booked, and then Kane in the number one contender spot theoretically. So for Verdum, honestly, he is likely one. Well, he is more than certainly than not one victory away from a title shot if he does in fact beat Marcin Tybura, which isn't a sure thing. But he's obviously in the mix. He's looked great, and the big problem for him is he is up there in age. So the time is definitely his enemy when it comes to getting a championship fight. And it's just for him in this fight, he's really got to stay focused outside of all the things that have happened outside the cage, as well as expectations moving forward. Because if he loses sight of Marcin Tybura, he's not going to have to worry about a title shot, because he'll have a loss on his resume.
I do want to say, kind of going back on the whole, you know, boomerang situation, I want to give some kudos to John Morkin, who was part of the scrum with Fabricio Verdum on Thursday, where, you know, it was asking about the incident, and clearly Fabricio Verdum didn't want to talk to it, but I thought John Morkin did a great job as a reporter to kind of keep pushing the issue to try to see if you can get any answers. So kudos to John Morkin about that. But one of the questions that came up was, you know, hey, is this going to be a distraction for you? I mean, my guess is it has to be in the back of Fabricio Verdum's mind, but I have to think, you know, when he steps into, you know, the cage, you know, Sunday morning in Australia, I got to imagine he's not even thinking about the legal aspects of what happened earlier this week.
Yeah, the fact that he has to show up in court is really making me sad. That, because just living through him, me living in that moment would be awful. Just showing up to court and you got to talk about how you threw a boomerang at somebody, that is literally the worst thing in the world. But obviously he has the ability to compartmentalize these things. The effect it may have is, you know, on the day that he threw a boomerang, he's had to deal with those questions. He spent a lot of time dealing with that, probably talking on the phone with people, and all that time that he could have been spent preparing for this fight mentally or physically, he spent dealing with that. So that's kind of the cost of the event that took place. And I would assume a fighter like Verdum, Jason, who has fought for such a long period of time in so many different martial arts, has a phenomenal ability to compartmentalize things and just fight. Because he obviously has a great ability to compartmentalize things. He compartmentalized hanging out with ruthless dictators. So I'm sure he can do this too.
When you look at Marcin Tybura on the other side, I mean, this is a guy that I think pretty much everyone expects for him to lose this fight, but he has made some changes. He's now training there at Jackson Wink in Albuquerque, New Mexico, so you're going to be kind of interesting to see. And very quietly, I think a lot of people probably, unless you've really looked up Marcin Tybura, don't realize that this man has won 3 in a row since losing to Timothy Johnson last year. Those wins against Victor Pesta, Luis Enrique, and most recently back in June against Andre Orlovsky. The win against Orlovsky did come by decision. And this is, you know, this is one of those matchups that the UFC puts together where, you know, I look at from Fabricio's aspect, like, what is there really to gain? To me, Fabricio has everything to lose in this matchup, where for Marcin Tybura, he has everything to gain.
Yeah, for Verdum, it's just put up the stats and get on the resume, because obviously a win over Marcin Tybura is not going to move up Verdum in the rankings. He's number 2. He's not going to – I mean, I guess theoretically he could go up to number 1 over Kane. I don't think that will happen, but it could. But yeah, not a whole lot to win. But that's kind of the position Verdum is going to be in until he gets a championship fight, just because there literally is only 1 or 2 fighters above him. And this is a big risk. And it's a bigger risk in the Walt Harris fight, simply because Tybura is much better. Marcin has shown in his last 3 fights and that he has a lot of power, both with his hands, his feet, as well as his ground and pound. And he's a really well-rounded fighter. And he's also very gritty. I mean, later on, finishing Luis Enrique, he kind of wore down in the Arlovsky performance, his most recent fight. But he looked really solid against a fighter in Andre who kind of returned to form in the junior Albini fight most recently. So when I look at Marcin Tybura, I see a fighter whose talent level really supersedes his name value. He screams upset potential. The problem for Tybura is you look at what he does well, and it kind of feeds into what Werdum truly excels at. Tybura can bully people in the clinch. In that aspect, Verdum's going to line him up with knees and elbows and a solid Muay Thai attack. Marcin has had success getting on top of opponents and landing ground and pound. Obviously, you can talk to Fedor Emelianenko about how good Werdum is off of his back. So then you move to the other aspect. Marcin is a solid striker. He may, in fact, catch Werdum on the feet, but I still might even give Werdum the edge on the feet. In fact, I probably would.
And Fabricio Werdum's actually been dropped in four of his last nine fights. I think one of the things when I think about Fabricio, and I do wonder if Marcin can take advantage of this. He does throw some lazy leg kicks that Fabricio would throw out there. Can he maybe time some of those to help him out? I do wonder, you know, what happens if Tybura can get this fight to the ground, you know, and be in a top position and land down strikes. I mean, obviously, I don't know if a quality game plan is a go to the ground with Fabricio Werdum, but it's a great opportunity. I know Werdum, he didn't seem to like the question that got asked him this week by one of the submission radio guys in the scrum, where he had basically was asked a question of, hey, how would you respond to people who said you have slowed down? And he didn't seem to really like that question. But you know, that's a realistic question to ask Fabricio Werdum when you look at his age. I mean, this guy is 40 years old, just turned 40 back in August. You know, you would, for the most part, you would say, hey, he is in the downside of his career, but you know, he is still one of the best heavyweights in the world. I mean, I'm picking Fabricio Werdum, but this could be a good spot for Tybura to pull the upset.
Yeah, these upsets we can't really see them coming. And in hindsight, surely we'll be talking about one or two fights that happened on this fight card that we did not see coming, where the big shot underdog won the fight. There are a fair share of underdogs on this card, and what's important we do here is kind of build the case for the underdog just so we can kind of compare and contrast what actually happened versus what could have happened. And to me, that's a good stat. Out of the last nine fights, nearly half of them you mentioned, Werdum was dropped. That's all it takes for Tybura to get a victory here. He certainly has the capability. Once again, as mixed martial artists age, there is more and more room. The window opens wider and wider for getting dropped and looking old overnight like a Cinderella. I believe that's how that works. Like she was in a pumpkin and then the pumpkin, I don't know. I don't really, I don't know Cinderella that well, Jason. I just know one thing. Werdum's probably going to win this fight. And what I really hope doesn't happen is that this one does not go to rounds four and five, because that could be ugly.
Yeah, we know how heavyweight fights can be, especially the fourth and fifth round. You speak of underdogs on this fight card, and I know we talked about this prior to UFC 216. It is kind of baffling to me of how much of a favorite Will Brooks is. You know, as we record this podcast here on Friday morning, Nick Lentz +435, Will Brooks -570. Of course, you know, there is a backstory, you know, to this fight with, of course, Nick Lentz recently left American Top Team, now trains at Combat Club there in South Florida. And, you know, the UFC clearly jumped on the opportunity to have a former ATT guy take on a current ATT fighter, because there has been a lot of guys that have left American Top Team. And it was interesting listening to the interview that Nick Lentz did with MMA Junkie, where he talked about what happened at UFC 216 and the health issues that he did have there, and you know, how much he's just feeling better where he's at right now. And you know, he mentioned, he's like, hey, you know, I did train a little bit with Will Brooks, but you know, training with somebody is not fighting somebody. It's two different things. And he is very confident leading into this one. He also in that interview kind of noted that you know, Will is, you know, kind of does pull some things where, you know, he tries to, he kind of laid out there of like he's trying to talk himself up a little bit in terms of the fight. But, you know, I'm picking Will Brooks to win the fight, but do I think he should be nearly a 6-1 favorite? No.
Yeah, I totally understand what you're saying. I mean, to me, the problem is, depending on whether or not Michael McBride is still in the UFC, I'm not super sure that Nick Lentz has a victory over a fighter that's still in the UFC. Because Manny Gambeiran retired, right?
I'm pretty sure about that.
Yeah, he retired. Diaz got released. Hakan Diaz got released. Danny Castillo was released. I'm pretty sure Diego Nunez isn't on the upcoming UFC Sao Paulo card. Don't know if AJ Mitsuoka is going to headline the next Yokohama Super Arena card. But depending on whether or not Michael McBride has another fight, not super positive that Nick Lenz has a victory over a fighter that currently is in the UFC. And I get what you're saying about the long odds totally, because that was my probably initial thought when this fight was first booked in the previous fight card. And then my second thought when I saw it again, it says a couple things. It speaks out because Will Brooks doesn't really prove it himself in the UFC as a guy you can go to the bank on as a massive, massive, massive 570, 550 favorite against a longtime veteran. Because Nick Lenz has a lot of cachet in our minds. He's just a scrappy fighter that can pull off upsets, pull off wins, and is really tough. And when you have the resume of Nick Lenz and you look back at Brooks' last two performances against the unrelated Oliveira brothers, it really makes you want to pick Nick Lenz in this fight so you can come across like Noster dumbass. But at the end of the day, I can't pull that trigger, Jason. Just because when the odds are that wide, it makes you think that, well, Las Vegas knows nothing.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's definitely something. That's a crazy stat that you point out there about Nick Lentz, and anyone can go look at Nick Lentz's record. Yeah, Michael Bryant, who's lost back-to-back fights in the UFC, I mean, man, that may be that is a unbelievable stat there. But, you know, obviously we'll see. But you know, the other side of it, and I think a side of this that really hasn't been talked about, is if Will Brooks loses this fight, does the UFC cut ties with him?
I mean, probably, because it's like if he loses this fight, it won't be a good one.
That would drop him to one in three in the UFC.
Well, yeah. I mean, the good thing is like everything before the UFC is so awesome. Like he has a win over Held and Jansen and a pair over Chandler. But 1-3, I don't know what his contract situation's like. Do you think he just signed a basic contract, or you think he had some leverage to do a little better than that?
My guess would be he's on a four or six fight deal would be my guess. But I mean, you got to imagine coming over from Bellator that, you know, they gave him, I mean, you look at, his disclosed salaries, you know, $57,000 for his fight against Alex Oliveira, disclosed salary of $100,000, you know, for his fight against Ross Pearson, which was $50,000 to show, $50,000 to win. You know, his last fight, did not have a disclosed salary out there. So, you know, you gotta kind of wonder if,
well, the UFC is telling you what they think about him, I think. Okay. So I'm looking at Wikipedia, and something that happens every time is I mention something that's incorrect, largely due to the fact that I got it off Wikipedia. We do this every show. I mention something. You're like, that's not how it is. It's like, screw you, Wikipedia. In fact, Wikipedia currently has the Volkanovski Shane Young belt listed at featherweight. It's a catchweight belt. Anyways, bottom line, I don't know if the UFC is telling you what to think of Will Brooks, because I do not believe Brooks and Nick Lentz is the main event for the prelim portion of the FS1 card.
They're which not. Is like, it's, which is like, it's a flyweight matchup between Benoit and Mokotarian.
Yeah, those aren't named fighters. And this whole card, like Brooks Lentz isn't on the main card, and it's not the main event at the prelim. So that kind of tells you maybe what the UFC thinks about Brooks. He probably needs to win, a loss likely out. We saw four Brazilians recently released, I believe, from the UFC. So maybe this time of the year where they start cutting costs. I think this is when you'll see more releases in the UFC as we begin to almost get into the new year, October, November, December. I think that's just usually when people fire people, because they begin to look – yeah, they begin to do like their financial deals for the next year. So this is likely chopping block season more often than not. That's what I would assume. Brooks needs to win, and so does Nick Lentz, because he has a lot of fights on his resume, and that's obviously how the scales work on the Adidas deal.
I mean, look, I'm interested in that fight, just kind of see how it does play out with a little bit of history there. But, you know, that's and it will be the next to last fight on the prelims on FS1. You got four fights on the Fight Pass or FS1 prelims. You have three fights on the Fight Pass prelims. Getting back to the main card, the co-main event, Beck Rollins against Jessica Rose Clark. Of course, this was a matchup that was initially supposed to be Beck Rollins against Joanne Calderwood. Calderwood pulls out of the fight due to an undisclosed injury. And, you know, for Beck Rollins, she is a fighter that has been, you know, for a while been calling for the UFC to bring in the 125-pound division. So it's finally here. And she noted this week of, you know, just how great that she does feel in terms of just, you know, kind of physically with, you know, not having to cut down to 115 pounds anymore. For Jessica Rose Clark, she was actually supposed to fight at Invicta FC on December the 8th in a 125-pound fight. Of course, she is coming off that win against Karina Dam at Titan FC 45 back in August, where she did get a split decision win over Karina Dam. Prior to that, she had lost back-to-back fights. And for Beck Rawlings, she has also lost back-to-back fights. She has lost to Tisha Torres and Paige VanZant. She lost to Paige via a stoppage there in the second round, and coming off a decision loss against Tisha Torres. And, you know, obviously this is a co-main event because of Beck Rawlings being from Australia. And when you look up and down this fight card of fighters are from Australia that are not fighting someone from Australia, it's almost like who's got the best chance to win. Is it Daniel Kelly? Is it Oshkin? Is it Tuivasa? Is it Damian Brown? You know, and I my guess would probably be, God, I hate to vote Daniel Kelly. He always, he always proves me wrong. Maybe it's Damian Brown, even though I'm not picking Damian Brown in that fight. But for Beck Rawlings, this is kind of an opportunity to, in a way, to revitalize her career.
Yeah. I mean, and to answer your question, not to spoil my pick, but I will. I think Tai Tuivasa is the pick there to win the Australia versus non-Australian battle. But now Rawlings, yeah, this is a great scenario for her. You know, women's flyweight bout, Australian versus Australian, pretty solid co-main event. Makes a lot of sense why it's in the co-main event because of that. Similar to what you were saying about the Bellator card with Noah Lahat being in the main event over Salter. It's just because they're catering to the market. Yeah. And that's probably the reason why. A pretty weak co-main event, though. It kind of establishes the issue with this card is that this is a half fight card. There's not even a one fight card. It's just Verdum. That's the name on this card. Rollins Clark, not a fight that resonates, but a fight that when you're actually watching it could be really fun, because I would anticipate you're going to see a frenetic pace in this contest. And the other thing I would anticipate is a lot of back and forth stand up. You mentioned Rose Clark's win over Karina Dam, certainly the career highlight. I just don't think, looking at Clark's resume and how she's fought, that she can contend with the combinations Rollins going to throw. I think Jesse may do a bit more from the outside. I just think Beck Rawlings' pressure is going to allow her to win a unanimous decision.
Yeah, I like Beck Rawlings as well. I think ultimately this fight will probably come down to who is a fighter that can get the fight to the ground and control the fight on the ground. My pick is Beck Rawlings. Now, Verdum Tybura is my number two fight of this fight card. My number one fight is Tim Means and Bilal Muhammad. I got to imagine this is probably the number one fight for a lot of people on this fight card. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. We're actually we are virtually identical with our one and two buddy, Means and Muhammad, number one, because it's a damn great fight. Verdum Tybura, number two, because it's an important one, kind of. But Means and Muhammad, ooh, I'm looking forward to this one. This is certainly the odds on favorite for fight of the night. Is that your pick for fight of the night?
Yeah, that is my pick for fight of the night. I think it's going to be interesting to kind of see if Tim Means becomes a little bit of a counter striker in this matchup. I mean, I love this fight. I mean, one of the things that Tim Means does have in this fight, he does have a 3-inch reach advantage in this matchup. So we'll see, how effectively he can use that reach advantage. But I mean, this is one of those fights where I just kind of sit back and say, how does this fight not deliver?
How does it not deliver if one of them slips on the way to the octagon? Or I guess if one of them attempts a grappling battle. I don't know who of these two will. Neither of these two, I believe, have competed at Abu Dhabi or ADCC. I don't know if they'll be at the next Eddie Bravo Invitational. I just think those two fighters that are incredibly confident in their stand-up. I think Tim Means is going to dictate it, and you're going to get a win out of Tim Means here. I think it's going to be a great fight.
My pick is Tim Means as well. My number three fight is actually the fight that's going to be right before that. It's the welterweight matchup of Matthews and Filekovic, who's got a 4-inch reach advantage. And this one, you got Jake Matthews is moving up to 170. I mean, so that's why Bohan's going to have a little bit of a size advantage in this one. You know, it's going to be kind of interesting to kind of see how Jake Matthews is able to fare at 170 pounds after, you know, starting off as a 155er in the UFC. Of course, he's coming off a loss against Kevin Lee and Andrew Holbrook. You know, this is one of those, it's, I'm picking Jake Matthews, and primarily I think it's because of he gets the fight to the ground, but man, I just don't feel comfortable in picking him.
Yeah, I understand your pick, and I feel the same way in reverse. I'm picking Bojan Velikovic, but I'm certainly not feeling comfortable in this pick either. The reason why I like Bojan is because he knows the weight class. To me, he hasn't really showcased his potential a whole lot in a lot of his fights. He looked really great in his last one. The biggest issue prior to that has kind of been his aggressive nature, lack of it thereof. What really works well for Bojan, I think, is his ability in size and to defend the takedown. I think he's going to defend the takedown and kind of showcase the technique to win. But Jake Matthews has flashed a lot of upside. This is a fighter who was a major, major prospect coming out of Tough Nations. He's had some failures paired with some successes, so that stifled the momentum. But this could be the night where he comes out and has a breakout performance. Jason, I just am picking Bojan here because I feel a bit safer with his size, and I do think he's incredibly well-rounded.
Yeah, that's kind of the thing that kind of scares me about Jake Matthews is the size disadvantage I expect him to have in the matchup. The second fight on the main card is going to be Elias Theodoro, Daniel Kelly. Daniel Kelly is a guy that, you know, I seem to go against pretty much every time. And this guy, more times than not, does prove me wrong. But, of course, age clearly not on his side as he just turned 40 years old on Halloween, taking on Elias Theodoro. Of course, Dan's coming off this fight after being knocked out by Derek Brunson back in June at UFC Fight Night 110. Prior to that, he had won 4 in a row against Steve Montgomery, Antonio Carlos Jr., Chris Camozzi, and Rashad Evans. You look at the other side of this, Elias Theodoro, who's probably one of those guys that really has taken advantage of using Twitter as a way to promote himself. He also comes in this fight off a loss, a decision loss against Brad Tavares. Prior to that, he had scored victories against Cesar Fajeya and Sam Alvey. I'm picking Elias Theodoro. I think, you know, because of him having a size advantage, particularly with the reach in this fight, a 4.5 reach advantage. And, you know, I'm going to go with the younger guy here and kind of once again voting against Daniel Kelly.
Congratulations, Daniel Kelly, on the victory because, man, Daniel Kelly, every time we don't pick the man and we're in unison, he always wins. This reeks of a Dan Kelly upset, a 32-second knockout. I just can't do it. After his last performance, I'm kind of out on the Dan Kelly hype train. If he does lose, it's important to note how fantastic the story has been. What sticks out is when you watch Dan Kelly fight, you know why he was in the Olympics. He showcases the mental toughness, the never-say-die attitude, the pragmatic genius aspect of, I may not have the physical tools, but I'm still going to get this done. So really, hats off to Dan Kelly. I just think Elias Theodoro just represents a fighter who really has a lot of physical advantages over Dan Kelly, and he's going to be able to utilize those advantages along with his skills, I think, to outpoint Dan Kelly and win this fight.
The opening matchup on the main card, catchweight bout of 150 pounds, Alexander Volkanovski taking on Shane Young. Volkanovski's been through multiple opponents on Tapology. They actually have Shane Young listed as the 4th different opponent. I believe one of those fights was actually never ever officially announced by the UFC. Shane Young, this is a matchup that Volkanovski talked about this week. Was actually there was a regional promoter that wanted to put this fight together prior to Volkanovski getting into the UFC. Shane Young, who is 11-3 in his career, you know, has been in that Australia, New Zealand scene. They've actually they've trained to get, you know, they trained in the same gym when Shane and his people came over to his gym, but never really had a, you know, quote unquote sparring session together. And Volkanovski is actually, I expect him to get a stoppage victory here, and he's one of my picks for performance of the night.
Yeah, mine too, and I think it's one of the safest picks for performance of the night because Volkanovski thus far has showcased himself as a destroyer of worlds, and in this matchup, he gets the benefit of a fighter taking this fight on such short notice. A fighter in Shane Young – who is really solid, I think, especially in the stand-up game. It's just that he faces a fighter where the gap is pretty significant, and he faces a fighter who is just a little lethal tank. And I think this will be a tough debut for Shane Young, but moving forward, if he gets another fight, which I assume he is owed one, he may in fact pull off a victory. And this one, Jason, these are the biggest odds I think you'll see all night in terms of who's the favorite. There's a big reason why. I think Alexander Volkanovski, who mentioned, I think, in his fight against, oh my goodness, I think it was his last fight, he said he was battling staph infection against Hirota. And anyways, he won that fight, and he looked really good. So I think Volkanovski is going to win and win with the performance tonight bonus as well.
And he mentioned that Jeremy Stephens is a guy that is on his radar. So, you know, a lot of the times, if you mention a name, the UFC more times than not is going to grant you that wish. We just saw that with OSP getting Aliyah Latifi, which is I don't understand that call out. I'll just leave it at that.
Well, look, bro, if I ask for broccoli for Christmas, you best guarantee my parents are going to give me a plate of broccoli for Christmas. Like, I'm going to get that Christmas present. That's not the hardest call out in the world. And shout out to OSP. I love it, man. He's got a thing for Aliyah Latifi that he wants to sort out. Go ahead and get it.
Stylistically, I don't understand that call out, because I can see, I mean, if you look at the weakness of OSP, it's a ground game in terms of the wrestling aspect of it. That to me is why kind of that call out's a little weird, but obviously, you know, maybe it's, you know, OSP and his coach Eric Turner are basically saying, hey, we want to kind of dispel this myth.
Yeah, and the other aspect of the, you know, head scratching nature of that call out is the value in terms of name value for your opponents. And a lot of times when you see a call out, the inner workings of said call out is you're calling out someone who represents a fighter with a better name value than you that will help you climb up the ladder at a faster rate. So there's the issue in terms of just stylistically, this is a tougher matchup for OSP than maybe somebody else he could have called out for. But it's also something where Aliyah Latifi isn't necessarily a light heavyweight that's selling a lot of Aliyah Latifi UFC fighter kits.
Yeah, but, you know, it's just, but, you know, look, you know, if you call somebody out instead of saying, hey, I'll give whoever the UFC wants me to fight, you know, the UFC, as long as it's a reasonable call out, it's not some crazy call out like you're not even a top 15 fighter, ranked fighter, and you're calling out the champion, that's not going to happen, but we'll see what happens with that one. In terms of the prelims, I have to imagine, I got to think that both of us are on the same wavelength here. In the fighter that we're most interested to see, I gotta imagine you've got the same thought I do, right?
Is it Frank Camacho?
No.
Oh, I was just saying because you interviewed him. Who?
Talavasi, the heavyweight.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was only looking at the TV prelims. Man, I ruined our beautiful moment. Talavasi. Is that how you say his name?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. I mean, but to me, when you talk about, first off, he is an eye commodity here, Daniel. I don't know if you know this, right? You do know how old he is.
Is he younger than 50?
He is 24 years old. He is a rare breed in MMA, a 24-year-old heavyweight.
Oh, my gosh, Jason. He should not start training for like 14 more years. This is interesting. And I think he's going to come out here and he's going to win. I mean, this guy's undefeated. He's got like a name that is alliterative.
By the way, I guess you must be looking at Wikipedia, because he is on the FS1 prelims.
He's on the FS1 prelims?
Yeah, he's not on the Fight Pass prelims. It'll be the second fight on FS1.
I absolutely despise you, Wikipedia. What the hell is wrong with the Wikipedia? You monster! I'm assuming then, you know who they have on the FS1 prelims, and it sticks out like a sore thumb now. There's no way Anthony Hamilton, Adam Wieseritz is on the...
No, that would be the first fight on Fight
Yeah,
Pass.
That's what they have on the FS1.
I think it was initially set that way, but yeah. I mean, but Tai is a guy that I am most interested to see. You know, this is his first fight since coming... Actually, it's a UFC debut, but also... First fight since coming off a knee surgery, coming off a win against Jamie McSweeney back in October of last year at Australian FC 17. And to me, you know, I mean, I'm picking him to win this fight against Rashad Coulter. But, you know, in terms of, you know, as you look ahead of, you know, guys who, you know, a year, 2 years from now that, you know, could be, you know, in that top 10 conversation, he's a guy that you have to be interested in.
He is, and he's not the only undefeated Australian that you look at debuting here that you think 2 or 3 years from now could be a name. The other one's the women's strawweight fighter, Nadia Qasim, against Alex Chambers.
Yeah, that's another one. That's actually the featured prelim on UFC Fight Pass. She fights out of Australian top team, which, of course, Ashkan, who is in the featured prelim on FS1, is in as well. She was actually Qasim was supposed to make her UFC debut back in June. That did not happen. She was supposed to take on J.J. Aldridge. Now she takes on Alex Chambers. I am picking Qasim to win that one. You mentioned about Frank Camacho. I did have a chance to interview him. If anyone missed that interview, it's on this week's podcast, or if you can go to themreport.com, it is in video form. Had a great conversation with him, just kind of, you know, who is he? He has this great documentary on his YouTube channel. If you want to kind of get to know who he is, I would recommend checking that out, dropping down 155 pounds, where basically just told me, said, hey, I'm not a 170er in the UFC. So, you know, he's got to take that drop down to 155 pounds. You know, on the other side of that fight, Damian Brown, he talked about this week of, you know, he has a regular job. And when he goes in the fight camp, he actually takes 2 months off from his job. And before he got this fight, he actually went into camp. He had no idea if he was going to get a fight on this card. Yeah, so he really took a gamble here. You know, so we'll see how well he performs there. You know, Ryan Benoit, I like him there in the flyweight matchup. I like Qasim. I like Eric Shelton, and I'm going to go with the Polish guy Adam over Anthony. I just, you know, that's more going against Anthony Hamilton than anything else.
Yeah, I feel like that's why the pick is. I'm picking him as well. Is you're looking at hedging your bets against a fighter who has shown a real issue when it comes to getting hit in the face, which, to be fair, I have real issues when it comes to getting hit in the face. And I empathize with that. You just kind of a strategy I usually look when I'm making these picks is if you see a fighter who's kind of on the way out against a debuting fighter, there's usually a scenario where more times than not, the debuting fighter looks like a dynamite train and debuts impressively. I think that's what we'll see here. You know, the fight you mentioned earlier, just recently, my number three fight on this fight card is actually Camacho and Brown. Mm-hmm. Not because of the name value of either fighter and not because of how high they are in the lightweight rankings. I just think Brown and Camacho, guys, is a sleeper for fight of the night. Maybe not even a sleeper. I think it's the second most likely fight to be fight of the night. Because I think Camacho and Brown are really content to throw some bungalows, especially Frank. He's got great power. He really can push the pace. I think Damian Brown will respond in nature. And Brown and Camacho is my third fight I'm most looking forward to. In fact, since you picked Means and Muhammad, I'll go with Camacho and Brown to be the fight of the night.
And, of course, that's all going to go down Sunday morning in Australia, Saturday night here in the United States. Of course, main card starts 10 p.m. Eastern time on FS1. Let's just quickly go through our picks. Just go from bottom all the way to the top. I'm going to go with Adam, Shelton, Qasim, Camacho, Tuivasa, Brooks, Benoit, Volkanovski, Theodoro, Matthews, Means, Rawlings, and Verdum. My fight of the night is going to be Means and Muhammad. My performance of the night will be Fabricio Verdum and Alex Volkanovski.
My fight of the night will be Means. Brown and Camacho. Performance of the night will be Fabricio Verdum and Alexander Volkanovski. And in terms of my picks, Ty Tuivasa, Shelton will beat Janelle Laza, Nadia Qasim, Frank Camacho, Adam Wieserich, which I'm just butchering that name, Will Brooks, Ryan Benoit, or Ben Wall, Alexander Volkanovski, Elias Theodoro, Bojan Velikovic, Tim Means, Beck Rollins, and Jason. I'm going to go out on a limb and pick Fabricio Verdum.
Really going out on a limb there. So,
yeah.
Of course, that is the UFC card on Saturday. Of course, a lot of MMA going on this weekend. If you listen to this on Friday, on UFC Fight Pass. You have Titan FC 46, Jose Shorty Torres in the main event defending the flyweight title, also there's a lightweight title in that fight. You've got the Bellator tape delay show on Friday night on Spike, which actually happened Thursday in Israel. So if you're looking to avoid spoilers, you know, just don't go on to maybe like Tapology or things along those lines. But really a fight card that doesn't really seem to have any buzz behind it at all. You know, really, you know, John Salter, you know, a top middleweight contender is definitely a reason to check out that fight card. I do have an interview up on theamereport.com with John Salter. I had a chance to catch up with him. Did talk a little bit about, you know, him and Derek Brunson trained a lot together. So that is on Friday. Of course, we mentioned the ACB show is on Saturday as well. I do want to kind of wrap up this preview podcast, talk about some of the latest MMA news and notes. It was on Thursday. The Ultimate Fighter did announce that they're doing an open casting call on Tuesday, December the 12th. In Las Vegas for the next season of The Ultimate Fighter, which will be season 27 called Battle of the Undefeated. They are looking for undefeated fighters in the men's 145, 155, and 170-pound weight classes between the ages of 21 and 34 that have to have an undefeated record with of at least 3 professional fights. And The Ultimate Fighter 27 scheduled to begin filming in January of 2018. And premiere on FS1 later on that year. Probably premieres April, May-ish. And, you know, when I got this this press release, Daniel, I was kind of like, okay. But then I'm like, Battle of the Undefeated? I mean, I get they're trying to find something to kind of get people attached to. But you look at the television ratings for this season, The Ultimate Fighter, with, you know, the inaugural flyweight title up for grabs. I'm like, man, I don't know what they can do to get people interested in this. My guess is this season you're probably going to see a lot of 3, 4, 5-0 top fighters. And then I think you're probably going to see a lot of fighters try out for this that may have an undefeated record, but the strength of schedule and the resume may not be the greatest.
Well, the great thing is everybody who fights, who enters it, will also leave it undefeated. That because it's all, they're all amateur bouts, which is a nice thing. Look, man. The story of the Ultimate Fighter over the last 27 years has been, that's a good idea, and it won't matter. But, you know, that's a good idea, and it won't matter. It won't matter in terms of the viewership, but who knows? Maybe you can build steam over the guy who ends up winning the show. I just don't necessarily think it will translate. In fact, I'm not super sure how big of a name the winner will be. But I think it's a nice idea, and it's one that you mentioned that you're going to have a vast majority of these fighters being 3 or 4 or 5 and 0. I mean, what do you think the best record will be on the show? Like 9 and 0? You think we'll get a double digit undefeated fighter on the show?
You couldn't. Andre Harrison, maybe?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, it could be the Andre Harrison show. The biggest problem is you're going to have to show his fights.
I
don't know.
I've seen Luis Pena, who's a regional champion. Luis is, I want to say now, is 4-0. Valor Fights champion. I've seen him on Facebook already mentioned that he wants to go out this. I mean, you know, there could be some fighters that maybe are tied up in contracts and that may be an Andre Harrison situation. I mean, you know, there's one name gets thrown out there. He's mentioned that, you know, his next fight, which is next week against Shinya Aoki, is his last fight. Would Ben Askren go out?
Oh my gosh. I don't think Ben Askren would ever go on The Ultimate Fighter.
I don't think he would, but I would. If you're looking for television ratings, could you get Ben Askren to commit to living in a house away from his family for 6 weeks?
No, I don't think so. I really don't, because I mean, he's basically retired essentially, right, after his next fight.
That's what he says. I mean, but what I mean, like, you know, I mean, look, I think one of the things that's going to kind of, you know, just as a fan of the sport, we've always wanted to see what Ben Askren can do in the UFC. I mean, look, I think it's, you know, highly unlikely you would see Ben Askren on The Ultimate Fighter, but I mean, you know, it's just, I've always just wanted to see Ben Askren against the elite UFC welterweights, just see how he would do.
Yeah, I really do too, and it's likely, if we don't see it happen, it's going to be something that's always a question that we'll always have about what his upside would have been. And unfortunately for Ben Askren, I don't think he's going to get the benefit of the doubt in these legacy conversations. I don't think people are going to say, well, he probably would have been welterweight champion. He has the wrestling credentials to certainly accomplish that task. I just really hope, you know, he's 33 years old. I hope he gets this fight out, and I really would love to see him fight in the UFC so we can answer that question.
Does Shane Aoki even make it out of the first round against him?
No, no. Well,
does he make it 3 minutes?
I mean, it's going to be pretty hard to tap Aoki, obviously.
I mean, Aoki is a small 155er.
That is true. You're right.
And now he's going up to fight Ben Askren at 170 pounds. I'm sure he's going to, you know, try whatever he can, any unique takedowns to try to get, you know, work his submission game. But I just see Ben just taking him down and just pounding him out, and it doesn't last long.
Yeah, I certainly understand what you're saying. It's just something where Askren really hasn't fought someone as good as Aoki, like, in a very long time, since probably his Bellator days. But the size is a big issue, right? He could just simply pound him out in a couple minutes. I don't know, man. I mean, it would be quite embarrassing if Aoki somehow locks on some weird heel hook or something and gets the victory, but that's super unlikely. And, you know, Shinya Aoki is another one of those fighters who, gosh, 6 years ago, I would have loved to have seen him in the UFC, or 5 years ago. Granted, I think at that point there wasn't a featherweight division, but I do think Aoki's actually, if you're doing just a long list of best fighters to not have fought in the UFC, he certainly wouldn't be at the top, but if the list is like 50 deep, he might be like 44.
Yeah, yeah. It's of course, that's one championship's coming up next week. So we'll see who ends up being on The Ultimate Fighter, which, I'll be honest with you, Daniel, I've not watched one episode of this season.
Yeah, me neither. I can't tell you who's doing what. I might binge watch it before the fight card.
I'm sure, you know, the week of the finale, I'll probably binge, you know, I'll go through and, you know, watch the fight, the, you know, the actual fights, but I have no interest in sitting there and for you know, a show that without commercial is probably anywhere between 42 and 46 minutes of sitting there and watching a good 30 minutes of just a reality show. I just want to watch the fights. I don't care about the reality aspect of it.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. It's just to what made that show work was the reality aspect. I mean, that's the whole concept, though. It's like The Ultimate Fighter is the type of show that is supposed to engage an audience that doesn't normally consume mixed martial arts. It's just that obviously has not achieved that task in a very long time. So then maybe for the UFC, you say, well, why don't we do a better job of garnering this towards the hardcore mixed martial arts fans, since this appears to be our only audience?
Yeah, I just have no interest. It just zero interest in that. And look, the ratings show on it. I mean, the ratings show just how bad it is. So we'll see what happens there. Of course, we do have a title fight now for UFC 219, Cyborg versus Holm. Of course, this fight was dead about, I don't know, a couple of days ago. And then all of a sudden, UFC's in dire need of a title fight. And this is where, as a fighter, you take advantage of those opportunities. It's not been officially set as the main event. You know, it does kind of seem like maybe trying to get Tyron Woodley as the main event, whether maybe it's against Nate Diaz. You know, look, you know, I think you could just kind of cash in on the Colby Covington business here, because I don't know if Colby, you know, will ever be, you know, this close to a title fight. I mean, maybe maybe if you want to do Woodley and Diaz, maybe you do Colby Covington and Kamar Usman, who now looks like he most likely needs a new opponent for this fight card, since Emil Meek has got some visa issues there. Let's just say Cyborg Holm is the main event of UFC 219. Over under pay-per-view buys, 300,000.
I would say under for sure. I don't think too many people are going to
shell up. If I said 250,000 buys.
I think this is a pay-per-view that's going to do 190,000, 180,000 buys.
You think?
People spend a lot of money this year on pay-per-views. And by the time this fight card is announced, we're probably going to have the Conor fight announced. And I think people are going to be like, I'm going to save my money for the Conor fight or the heavyweight fight. I mean, and it's just one of those things where I don't necessarily know how big of a middle ground there is for UFC buys at this point. We've been surprised by a couple cards lately, and I just think 190,000 is probably where UFC 219 would be with the Holm Cyborg fight.
I mean, look, I think if Cyborg Holm was the main event, it would really tell us about what truly is the drawing power of Chris Cyborg. Are people willing to pay $60 to watch her fight? Now, if Woodley Diaz is the main event, that will also tell us a lot of what is the drawing power with Nate Diaz without Conor McGregor. But you're Nate Diaz, like, do you just sit and wait for the Conor fight?
No, because it's not going to happen if you just sit and wait. You got to demand it. I mean, Conor's next fight, I'm pretty confident it's going to be against St. Pierre. I just don't see, like, it's just, it makes all the sense in the world. And I just don't think the Diaz-McGregor fight is going to happen next, because I feel like if it was going to happen, it probably should have happened a lot sooner than, you know, like it should have happened in the heat of the moment, fresh off all the momentum of their most recent performance. Now the emotion isn't necessarily there, and now you just look at, for Conor, which one fight is going to do you the best business, and to me, the St. Pierre fight is above and beyond the answer.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's the biggest fight out there. I don't know if you saw Khabib had a little tweet with an emoji towards Tony Ferguson. You know, I don't know if that means Edson Barboza's out of the fight, but as I've said, I think if you're Tony Ferguson, you got to sit and wait for Conor. You got to let this thing play out for a couple months before you kind of jump in there, just because of the amount of money that's on the table. Potentially for Tony Ferguson to fight Conor McGregor. The other note that I wanted to mention was Ali Yacht. I thought it was interesting. A story on BodyElbow.com this week was talking about lobbying efforts. Of course, it's well known, you know, the UFC lobbying against it. And, you know, of course, you have the MMA FA, who is obviously, you know, I don't know how much financially they're putting into this, but in terms of man hours, they're lobbying for this and understand why they're lobbying for it. But, you know, it's always, you know, in the past, we've always heard Scott Coker say, you know, hey, I'm for the Ali Act, you know, for the fighters, whatnot. But in this article, it comes out that Viacom and their lobbying efforts on multiple, you know, things that they're lobbying for. One of the things they're lobbying against is the Ali Act. No one should be surprised by this.
Yeah, and I'm glad that's being covered, because that's something that could have gone under the rug. And it's something where you have the PR aspect of it being like, oh, we are proponents of this, but the people with legitimate lobbying power are in fact against it.
Yeah, I mean, look, everyone knows it's the potential of an Ali Act coming to MMA is not ideal for promoters. You know, and I've always said this. I think if the Ali Act does come to MMA, and I still think this is still a long way away. You know, my understanding is there's going to be another hearing sometime early on in 2018. And it'll be interesting to kind of see how this goes about. I mean, you know, I think it's a step in the right direction. Is it the ultimate answer to make things better in this sport for fighters? I don't think so. But I think it's a step in the right direction.
Yeah, there's no ultimate answer. There's no silver bullet. There's going to be so many issues for the sport that we need to solve or attempt to make better. And I think the Ali Act would certainly make things better, especially for those that are being put in rough positions because the promoter does not have their best interest in mind. They have the best interest of their opponent, since the promoter manages said fighter. So that's a positive. But again, this is a sport with so many issues. And I mean, to me, the biggest storyline that we will have in this sport's history will come soon. And it's going to be the ability to diagnose CTE in people as they, while they are alive.
I think one of the things that I look at is it's going to be interesting to me to see if Conor McGregor ever testifies. That would be like, that's gotta be worst case scenario if you're Zuffa.
Yeah, that's because Conor's got all the chips, and that is something that, I mean, the hardest part is getting him in court. I mean, I can't really imagine Conor testifying on time, but that certainly would be something I think he would utilize to leverage when it comes to negotiating a contract or a fight deal.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to kind of see how that does ultimately play out there. But I thought it was very interesting to kind of see, you know, because Viacom's really been quiet on the Ali Act, and we'll see what happens there. But we've got a busy weekend in MMA coming up with the UFC card, plus some regional shows going on as well. Of course, you got the Bellator card, which happened on Thursday of this week in Israel, of course, airing Friday night on Spike. Also on Friday night, you've got the CES card on Access TV, CES 47, Greg Rebello, his first fight since losing in the Contender Series. He's a part of that fight card, so that'll be Friday night on Access TV. Of course, I'll be back on Wednesday. Danny will join me as we'll recap everything that happened on this fight card. Also, we'll start to line up some interviews for Fighters going to be a part of that fight show. Just give me a follow on Twitter at Jason_Foy to find out who is going to be on next week's podcast. Of course, follow Daniel on Twitter at Daniel Galvan DGG. And be sure to check out our sponsor, Fight TV, as they've always got a ton of MMA, wrestling, and boxing. Download that app, fite.tv/radioinfluence/. So let's go wrap it up for this edition of the MMA Report Preview Podcast. I'll be back on Wednesday for the next episode of the MMA Report Podcast, which you can always listen to on radioinfluence.com, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, and Google Play.
This is a Sitting Ringside with David Penzer, Quick Fix on Radio Influence.
I'm assuming that you watched it, and I'm wondering what you thought, because as somebody who's a longtime fan and a huge Ric Flair fan, I'm wondering what you thought, because I lived it. I mean, there's nothing that was in there that surprised me. It surprised me that certain people said it out loud and that they aired it, but nothing in there that surprised me as far as that goes. So I'm wondering, as a fan, what were your thoughts?
I love the candidness that that Rick spoke with. You know, I loved obviously hearing, and I have obviously known his career for a long time as far as, you know, where he had gone, the promotions, the territories. But I think the part that at least hit with me really hard was the personal life. You know, to hear his kids talk on camera. For him to openly admit, you know, he just wasn't home all the time. And, you know that happens with wrestlers a lot. You know, they talk about being on the road 300 days a year and they're just not around. It's just the nature of the line of work they're in. But to hear his kids speak and to hear about, you know, he was bored being home. He, you know, he would head over to, you know, another wrestler's house to hang out for a while, but just to hear the family side of it, to hear the humanistic side of it, and to finally hear that the Ric Flair persona, it really became too much for him to walk away from. I mean, you know, the family life in some ways wasn't for him in the early going. So I love the human interest side of it. But Rick's a candid guy. I mean, you know him probably just as well as anybody. But I loved it. I loved it. I don't know if I could necessarily pick out one aspect that I liked the best about it, but I think overall it was such a well-done piece. And I think it was really neat that they did two-part interview with him, meaning interview him in a one time, and then 16 months later they went ahead and they did a second interview with him. So I loved it. I have nothing to bark about, and all the emotion was in there. Did you feel that as well, that it wasn't just a story, but it was this person's life that they had lived, and all these people around them were there because they had shared moments with him?
Yeah, I mean, Rick's an emotional guy. We all know that. And, you know, Rick is far from perfect, as he said himself. And that's the part that I wonder as a fan. Of course, with social media and the internet, you know, fans know way more now than they did back, you know, in the 80s and 90s. But, I'm wondering, as a fan, you know, somebody who walked down the aisle of their wedding wanting to wear a Ric Flair robe with belts, and we're not going to relive that. But I'm just trying to point out that that's how much of a fan you were. I'm wondering if it disappointed you that he's a real person with some real big flaws.
I mean, I think when you look at that side of it, you know, going into it, that you're right. No one's perfect. And that he can admit to that as well. Were there some aspects that I kind of was like, I don't know if I necessarily align myself with as far as family values and whatnot? Yeah, of course. Absolutely. When it came to the topic of monogamy, you know, I kind of cringed a little bit. But once again, he lives his life the way he does. I live the life the way I do. Just because you don't see eye to eye on every necessarily moral stance, it doesn't mean that you can't still respect people. As far as I'm concerned, I don't see anybody that Rick has gone out of his way to hurt. if that makes sense. I know things might not have always worked out relationship-wise, but it never feels like people are outwardly angry towards him. Does that make sense? I really feel like everybody kind of for the most part is just that's Rick.
I think that they did for a long time. I think as he got into his 60s and got older and he still continued with the shenanigans, I think that a lot of people I know that a lot of people started rolling their eyes. There's, you know, there's a time in someone's life where they have to sort of be, you know, stop being a character and you know, move to the next phase of your life. And I think until he almost died, quite frankly, I don't think he was able to do that.
Sitting Ringside with David Penzer can be found on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Play, and RadioInfluence.com.